Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Today we're joined by Hema Raghavan and Scott Meyer of LinkedIn. Hema is an engineering director responsible for AI for growth and notifications, and Scott serves as a principal software engineer. In this conversation, Hema, Scott, and I dig into the graph database and machine learning systems that power LinkedIn features such as people you may know and second degree connections. Hema shares her insight into the motivations for LinkedIn's use of graph-based models and some of the challenges surrounding using graphical models at LinkedIn scale, while Scott details his work on the software used by the company to support its biggest graph databases. Before we get going, I'd like to send a huge thanks to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's show. LinkedIn Engineering solves complex problems at scale to create economic opportunity for every member of the global workforce. AI and machine learning are integral aspects of almost every product the company builds for its members and customers. LinkedIn's highly structured dataset gives their data scientists and researchers the ability to conduct applied research to improve member experiences. To learn more about the work of LinkedIn Engineering, visit engineering.linkedin.com/blog. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am here with Hema Raghavan and Scott Meyer of LinkedIn. Hema is an engineering director and responsible for AI for growth and notifications. And Scott is a principal software engineer. Hema and Scott, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm very glad to be here at LinkedIn and looking forward to our conversation and digging in to some of the things you're doing with graphs for machine learning, empowering various LinkedIn features. But before we dive into that, I'd love to introduce our audience to you. So Would you take a minute to share a little bit about your background and how you got started working on graphs and in machine learning? Hema?
Okay. So I've been in the field of machine learning for several years now. I got my PhD back in 2006, largely focused on search and information retrieval. I've worked in advertising. I've worked in question answering systems at IBM, IBM Research in particular. And then when I came to LinkedIn, I came in to actually work on content recommendations. And I spent a year doing that. And I realized that one of the fundamental assets that LinkedIn has is the underlying social network, and that's where content propagates. And I got really interested in the problem of building the graph, in particular thinking about algorithms for people you may know, like problems or follow recommendations and so on. And that's what brought me from the general area of search and information retrieval to graphs. And it's been 4 years and I'm still having fun.
Fantastic. Fantastic. How about you, Scott?
Well, let's see here. I guess the story starts, I did relatively well in the dot-com boom and actually quit for 3 years to go sailing. And at the end of that, I was semi-reluctantly looking for a job, and I bumped into this company called MetaWeb, and they were like, hey, we want to build a world-writable graph of all common knowledge, and by the way, we're going to call this thing Freebase. And I was like, wow, I would really regret not taking that job. So I wound up leading the storage team at MetaWeb. MetaWeb was acquired by Google. Freebase became Google's knowledge graph. Spent 4 years at Google working on knowledge graph infrastructure. I think the best summary of that is Google and I disagreed about graph databases. But LinkedIn found me actually through LinkedIn, which was a huge endorsement, and recruited me to come here and lead a next generation graph database project. So that's what I've been doing for the last 4.5 years. So it's like 15 years in graph databases now. Can't shake the habit.
So we're going to go deep into graphs and the way LinkedIn uses them. We spoke a little bit about this with in a previous interview with Romer, who's one of your colleagues, Hema. But we'll dive even deeper here. Mm-hmm. But to kind of contextualize that for us, talk a little bit about the motivation for the emphasis on graphs at LinkedIn.
Yeah. So the social network for LinkedIn, we are an online professional social network. The fundamental asset that a user has on LinkedIn, perhaps in even comparison to our competitors, Indeed, or any of the other job sites, is the social network. So in that context, a graph is the prime driver of all of the other parts of our business at LinkedIn. In particular, if you can just think about it intuitively, it makes sense that when you're looking for a job, the most common thing for you to do is actually reach out to your first degree connections. If you are in a job that you like, you might want to stay informed through what your first degree connections are talking about. And that's pretty much what your feed does. And if you are likely missing out on a conversation, then your notifications are what are sent to you. And notifications from your first degree connections are more valuable than otherwise. So at all stages of your professional network, your connections are your core asset. And that's the core of what LinkedIn offers. So in terms of the set of AI problems that surround graphs, is first building the graph itself. So when a member comes in, the most primitive way that a member would build their network is go by memory and think about all of their colleagues that actually exist on LinkedIn and go and do a search. Now, you would not get a lot of coverage that way. I would probably not remember colleagues from 10 years ago when I'm building my network. So that's when a recommendation engine like People You May Know comes in. Likewise, for the feed, then how do you know which of your first degree connections are actually relevant to your current context? So I may have colleagues from school, from three other jobs before, but maybe the conversation that I really care about in today's context is deep learning and AI. So which of those colleagues are contextually relevant to my feed? So that's also a graph problem. We can think about it as affinity modeling amongst your first degree connections. Likewise, if you're on the jobs page, then which of your connections are relevant to you and who might potentially give you a referral, right? So all of these are graph problems. They can be modeled as prediction. They can come down to prediction problems given a certain context. The People You May Know problem is what edge should I build? And that is most relevant for the member. And then the other problems like feed, notifications, or jobs say, the member has a set of edges. Which of these edges are most relevant in that context? So that's graphs are everywhere at LinkedIn.
So LinkedIn is clearly already doing this. Mm-hmm. When you think about the big challenges or opportunities in this space and among the various features that you've talked about, People You May Know and the feed, what are those big challenges from a machine learning perspective?
Correct. When I think about graph problems, I actually think the challenge as compared to other recommender systems is often scale, because in the limit, a lot of these problems are n squared. So if you have a graph that's 500 million members, then you're looking at n squared of that. So there's no way that you can talk about some of these problems without having a distributed systems expert co-seated at the table with you, which is part of why we're in this conversation today together with Scott, right? So in fact, that's the one piece we realize that even when we're training the models, like just thinking about network propagation algorithms or about inference on these large graphs, there is a community, a research community out there, but it's not as prolific as perhaps, other fields of AI, for example. Text and NLP have broader communities. Mm-hmm. And it's perhaps also because the problem space is rather niche. Mm-hmm. So those are the biggest challenges. The lack of large data sets for academia to publish research that necessarily we can directly leverage from. So oftentimes we are pushing the boundaries internally ourselves. And there are a few problem spaces which sort of intersect so closely with distributed systems and AI.
Scott, how about from your perspective, what are the big challenges in addressing this scale?
Yeah, well, interestingly, I had a conversation with a recruiter when I came in, and he said, look, the magic in LinkedIn is in the second degree. That is, it's in connections that you could have, but probably don't. So, for example, any problem that you're experiencing, probably there's somebody in your second degree who has solved it or who knows more about it than you. And you may not know this person. Conversely, with the first degree, like mostly you already know it. It's, you know, top of mind. From the standpoint of data, a second degree is very difficult to work with, right? Because it's big. The way it got big is because it changes rapidly. So if I talk about storing first degrees, this is very easy to do with a key value store. However, if I were to try and materialize second degrees, the data footprint would be huge and the write rate would be enormous. And so there isn't a simple brute force solution to working with a second degree. So one of the key things that a graph database does, probably the defining thing, is joining. And in particular, we join two first degrees to put together a second degree, and we have to do this interactively in real time.
In talking about graph databases, where does the graph database sit in the process of kind of serving up these graph-based features? Is it kind of at the end of the chain, you know, close to where a page is being rendered, or is it kind of early in the chain, serving up the models?
Our online, we are an online service, so mm-hmm. It's fundamental to LinkedIn. If the graph is down, LinkedIn does not display web pages. Mm-hmm. And you'll see it all over the site. For example, graph distances, how far apart you are from someone you're looking at. That's computed out of the graph. So the graph itself is definitely online. The graph, the contents of the graph, some of it is raw data that is curated directly by users, and some of it is the result of a relevance or AI process where we take data that may be unreliable and figure out what's good. For example, filter out spam.
Okay. And so is the graph a single monolithic system, an instance of a graph database, or are there multiple systems that contribute to making the graph real for...
The graph is an instance of a graph database. We actually have 7 instances in 4 different colos to actually provide a continuous service. And the instance of the graph database itself is a cluster of machines, roughly 20 terabytes of RAM per cluster.
And is this an LinkedIn kind of internally developed graph database, or is it an open source project? Or
this is a complete internal project. It's built. It's an in-memory database. It's built on top of basically bare Linux.
Okay. Oh wow, wow. And so you talked about Hema. You talked about across these different capabilities, the common thing that you're trying to drive for across the graph is relevance, some mm-hmm. aspect of relevance. Mm-hmm. You mentioned affinity modeling is one of the types of technical approaches that you're applying. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So let's take affinity modeling for the people you may know problem, and then we'll talk about it in the context of some other problems. So the people you may know problem says, is A likely to know B? Mm-hmm. But we also want to consider long-term value. So if A may know B, but if they're not going to derive value on LinkedIn in any potential future, right? Like, is it worth connecting to your neighbor down the road? Like, should we be showing it's someone you know, but using a top slot in a recommendation system for that versus perhaps somebody who might be a good referral for a job for you down in the future, or someone who may share really good content, like someone that you know, but they just write really well and you would benefit from their writing. Mm-hmm. these, so you can think about predicting future edges or predicting. So what we're doing is actually predicting future edges, right? Is HEMA likely to connect to SAM? And so is HEMA likely to send an invitation to SAM? And is SAM likely to accept that invitation? So you have to know that, you know, HEMA knows SAM and SAM also knows HEMA. So it's a two-way problem. And but you want more than just that edge in building that edge in itself. You want to be able to predict that once HEMA and SAM connect, what's the likelihood that they're going to interact? And interact could be in the context of a job. Interaction could be in the context of the feed or a notification or some other context. So affinity turns into a predictive problem. You can generalize it to, are you likely to interact in some context in the future? And how likely is a person likely to accept an invitation from a person and derive value from that? So those are all the broader problems that we're trying to solve when we're building edges.
So one thing that comes to mind for me in thinking about that is you've got this graph database that is presumably you're capturing the nodes, which are the people, mm-hmm. And some aspect of the relationships, the edges. Mm-hmm. But you're also, when you're making these predictions, are you then taking the high likelihood predictions and then putting them into the graph database? I guess I'm trying to reconcile the graph as this kind of existent thing mm-hmm. that's captured, you know, concretely in a database, and this predicted thing that, you know, doesn't exist. And when does it get kind of materialized into the database?
Got it. So the existing graph is the existing set of members and their connections. And it can actually be richer than that. You can have nodes in the economic graph of LinkedIn. You can have nodes that are schools, companies. You can have edges that people follow. So that rich database in its current state. So if you take a snapshot in time, that's what Scott's team built, serves for all of LinkedIn. And then what we do is, given that snapshot, how do we query it to get the potential second degree? These are people who are not connected to each other. And then potentially even third degrees for low degree members, because if your second degree is too sparse, we might want to walk the graph out a little more. So we look at the second degree, the third degree, and that itself is huge. Even if a few of your second degree nodes have 30 odd connections each, that can blow up in computation. So we take that large list and then we say, all of these people are not connected to each other. Which ones are likely to connect to each other? And that's the predictive problem. And that's what you see on the people you may know or even follow recommendation pages at LinkedIn. And once people start sending invitations, so in the bidirectional edge is a connection edge. So when they send an invitation and it gets accepted, it materializes back into the database. A follow recommendation will materialize right away. And so Scott maintains the state of truth of, you know, what or of what connections have been accepted, as well as what follow links exist.
Okay. I see the people you may know page mm-hmm. all the time,
yeah.
And you certainly wouldn't want to recompute that every time I'm going to see it. So it needs to be cached in some kind of way. Is it cached outside of the graph database? That's also a graph. Why not put the potential kind of secondary connections into the graph as well? Like, and it is kind of a turtles all the way down kind of problem.
That's a very
right?
good question, because the assumption around, could we take a state of the graph, a time and point, maybe once a week or once in every n days, and then take the second degree network and then actually build recommendations and cache it in some kind of key value store. Was the premise with which LinkedIn built the people you may know system for several years. But something we discovered in more recent years was that network building is contextual. So when people say, people don't necessarily engage with a people you may know application or as a daily use case, but when they do, it's long and deep sessions. And say if you joined a company and you connected with your manager, if we could in real time then explore the second degree network from that new connection itself, right? Then you start exploring nodes around that company, around perhaps, you know, the team. You will start discovering some of these patterns, and people go down PYMK and they go click, click, click. And then if we can actually refresh those results in each subsequent scroll, based on how we're walking that graph, we actually discovered that we can show significant improvements in member experience. So actually walking the graph in near real time has been one of our internal discoveries, so to speak. The fact that we can actually do it and the fact that it gives huge improvements in experience and performance has been one of the key insights in recent times.
And it strikes me that there are significant kind of systems level challenges there. Is that in your realm or is that?
Yeah, I can speak to that. So I think traditional graph processing, something like Pragel or GraphX, the notion is I'm going to process the entire graph. And if you're going to process the entire graph, The way that you serialize the graph is really important because serial I/O, you know, when you can read disk blocks in order, is much, much faster than random access. And so a lot of graph processing focuses on clever ways to serialize the data and the processing so that you do the most efficient processing. The tack we've taken is, what if we used random access, right? So for random access, you've got to be in RAM. Your basic problem is how fast can I get something from memory into the CPU? So you're counting L3 cache misses. Basically, every link that you follow is an L3 cache miss, at least. That would be if you followed it with a pointer. In practice, we would like to follow links in constant time. It's a little bit more expensive. We typically average out between 2 and 3 L3 cache misses. By building a system which can do this, you can now use edges pretty much the way you use pointers, pretty casually. And you can do, say, online materialization of a second degree in real time.
I'm not sure that this is a direction that I really want to go down, but you know, when you're talking about kind of optimizing around cache hits and avoiding cache misses, you know, there's a whole emerging field of like baking machine learning into the low level infrastructure here to make some of these predictions for you. Is that something that you're, are you there yet? Are you thinking about it?
I've heard of that. What I do is a lot more boring. It's really nuts and bolts, retrieve data, figure out if it's the data that you want.
Okay.
You know, pretty boring database stuff.
Okay. A lot of the challenges for building machine learning systems at scale have to do with kind of the data pipeline and getting that in place before you even get to modeling. Does having access to this graph database alleviate all of that for you, or are you still wrangling with data pipeline types of issues?
So, data pipeline issues exist definitely for modeling because oftentimes models are still built offline. Prototyping is done offline. I mean, a graph database comes in when you're actually serving. So one of the pieces around making data pipelining easier has been what LinkedIn calls productive ML or pro ML. And we have actually facilitated tooling to become much more easier for data scientists to actually build prototypes. Now, that said, we have also started thinking about how do we make computing graph features? Because if you have a data scientist who wants to try a slightly different variant of a second degree algorithm, because we talked about a very simple version, which is get me all the second degree nodes. But if you want to think about it as a probabilistic random walk and you want to weigh the edges in terms of by a model, right? Like how close people are based on some of these affinity models that we talked about. How would it be easy for a data scientist to not have to worry about scale? So, you know, can we just provide an interface, a simple, maybe Jupyter Notebook-like interface to actually query these kind of databases? So we're working on these, and that makes the life for our data scientists easier. So, and that definitely takes away the data pipeline issues or the scale issues.
And when you get to modeling, can you talk a little bit about the modeling, the types of models that folks are building to solve these types of problems? Are there, you know, a few kind of go-to models that you apply broadly, or do you customize the models very deeply for the specific types of problems you're attacking here?
Yeah. So at the very basic, oftentimes for any kind of affinity modeling, we would start with the simplest class of models: decision trees, logistic regression, and so on and so forth. That said, we do find benefits in deep learning-like models. So there are some, this published literature, in particular, there is a GraphSage algorithm that came out of work from...
Which algorithm?
GraphSage. Yes, and that has come out of... Stanford and Pinterest. So we've done variants of those. We see certain advantages to algorithms of that nature. So deep learning definitely is one direction we're pursuing. Another direction is just personalization. So how do we think about different users who are in different stages of career building? You may be a new user and you may be building your graph and what LinkedIn calls a novice member. So you're more tentative to send out invitations. You're showing you somebody that you're likely to connect in that context makes a lot more sense. So knowing the stage of the user, the degree of connectivity of the user and the life cycle of the user is particularly important. And likewise, for someone who's very well connected already, the additional value of a connection may be much lower. So how do we find that one connection that that person's missing? So personalization is something that the simple models like logistic regression would not achieve. So we get to more advanced models like, mixed effect models.
Okay. I'd like to explore some of these. So GraphSage, what's that trying to do?
So GraphSage looks at, most deep learning models have, if you think about body of literature in text processing or NLP, typically looks at sequences of words. There are a few models that actually look at general graphs, right, for deep learning. So essentially what GraphSage is trying to do is similar to what Vertovec or might be trying to achieve, which is trying to learn a representation or an embedding. But it takes into account properties of the node and it takes into account the graph structure. So for example, you may be a sparsely connected node, but connected to one densely connected node with very rich profile features. Can I actually infer some properties about the sparsely connected node, which with an incomplete profile from the densely connected node? So actually looking at network propagation, looking at the structure of the underlying graph is the class of algorithms that we're going after.
Okay, so thinking about it as a graph embedding kind of approach, you're building a model that is finding relationships ultimately between the nodes, mm-hmm. that such that in this embedding space, nodes that are close together have similar properties.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you also mentioned mixed effect models. What are those?
Yeah. So as in, the way I want to sort of generalize that class of models is how do I learn models that are specific to certain groups and groups that are learned automatically, right? So we can think about it as a logistic regression is a simple linear, like a simple formula, which does not necessarily consider effects of the viewer, so the member that's being for whom the recommendations are being rendered, or doesn't take into account personalized features of the items being recommended, right? Mm-hmm. Or you would actually have to hand code these deeply into a logistic regression model. But classes of models that can actually learn subgroupings of people and learn those interactions between the viewer, that is for whom it is being recommended, and the items that are being recommended, and learn interactions between them.
So is it fair to think of it as almost conditional clustering? Like you're clustering conditioned on who's a specific node or something? Or
the other way people can think about it, these are also hierarchical models. Like in more classical statistics literature, you can think of taking all of your feature data and actually building clusters. So, you know, you think about, you called it conditional clustering, but just building these groups and then almost learning a separate model for each group. But not having to hand code these groups by themselves, letting the model info what these groups may be.
And then we jumped into some of the more advanced models that I wasn't familiar with. But in thinking about the application of kind of your linear regression and other basic models to graph types of data, are there unique kind of challenges or approaches to doing that, or is it kind of pretty standard to the way you do a linear regression on more simple types of data?
Yeah, so the challenges for a simpler model would often be just the volume of data we have for training. So just processing all of that data can often be a challenge. The other part is feature computation. So if you actually were computing something like just the number of common connections between two nodes, that can be a pretty heavy computation you have in an offline system like Spark or MapReduce. And the other piece is the online serving. So actually inference can be a challenge. So if you're actually thinking about how the PYMK is rendered, we talked about near real-time candidate generation. So what happens is if Sam comes to his PYMK page, we need to look up features for Sam, but then we may have a few thousand candidates to rank for Sam. So then we have to look up all of the features for those few thousand candidates. So then we're pounding a key value store at our PQPS for that many candidates. Then you start hitting, again, systems challenges to actually retrieve all of those features at that rate. So both at the data munging side for just offline analysis or feature engineering, some of these graph features can be computationally complex, and you're doing a lot of large joins. So we actually become smarter at the way we do joins, just simple SQL-like big joins don't necessarily work that well for us at the scale that we're at. And then again, online inference is the other piece.
In terms of those joins, Scott, what does work?
What does work? I think the two problems with joins are query planning. So typically, if you talk about a graph, it's represented as a table of edges. This is very, very easy to do in any SQL database. However, when you start to query it, you're doing self-joins. And the problem with self-joins is that the optimizer is based on statistics. And after your first round of projections, you no longer have any statistics. This gets exacerbated by the fact that graphs tend to have a lot of skew in them. That is, some nodes are very, very dense, and others are very sparse. And so basic techniques like, oh, I'll just take an average, don't work very well. You know, you can be looking at things, oh, this guy has 200, 150, 113, 25 million. right? Mm-hmm. So if you have to look at 25 million things, you have to pay that price. But if you're in a complex query, maybe you don't have to. Maybe that highly skewed node will be knocked out by some other condition. So you need an optimization framework that can respond to that problem of skew. And then this typically shows up in offline jobs where you have a hot shard. All the other shards are done, and one shard is just spinning at 100% CPU, or it runs out of RAM. That's a very typical problem. And the query planning we solve with a dynamic planner rather than a static planner. So typical SQL database, you give it the query, it looks at the statistics of the tables that are referred to, it comes up with a plan, and then it just executes the plan without change. What we do is we look at the query, look at the sizes of sets, which we can determine in constant time, and we do the cheapest thing. And then we see what that's done to the sizes of sets, and we do the next cheapest thing. So if we're pursuing a cheap branch and it turns out to be expensive, we'll go look at other cheaper things. So we'll change the query plan in midstream, as it were.
Hmm. The hot shard problem that you were mentioning, is that something that you deal with kind of operationally, or is that something that does this kind of dynamic element of the underlying platform know how to deal with that?
It's something that Liquid, the graph database, it's something that our planner handles.
Okay.
So it's a problem that we don't have in the online world. In the offline world, it's just a thing that can happen, right? So very often people are grumbling about their offline job not finishing and, oh, well, we need to give everybody more memory, or we need to fiddle with the query plan for this particular thing that we're computing. It's just a bad thing that can happen.
And when you say fiddle with the query plan, how much of that query planning is kind of hand-tuned like that versus the system is creating the query plan?
It varies a lot. The tendency is for things to be more SQL-like, where somebody else figures out the plan. But mm-hmm. A lot of people are still writing handwritten MapReduce jobs where you are actually, the human programmer is figuring out a plan that the computer program will exit. And, the programmer has to realize, hey, if I want to talk about people who are following Richard Branson, I probably don't ask about the shard that has Richard Branson. I probably ask all the other shards, like, hey, if you're connected, if anybody that you have is connected to Richard Branson, I want to do some stuff with that, right? So that's a typical way to work around that problem.
Is that type of thinking natural for the kinds of engineers that are working on these problems, or is there a lot of education and?
Yeah, I don't think it's natural for anyone. graph databases, it takes a while to. There's no top or bottom, so I've always seen it takes at least 6 months for people to come up to speed on the domain and uh-huh. and really start being productive.
Sounds like the new concurrency, right? It's like something you just have to wrap your head around. There's this fog, and eventually you come out on the other side of the fog, and it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm curious about if you're seeing anything happening on the hardware side of supporting graph databases. It strikes me that there's maybe an analogy in, there are a number of companies going at doing machine learning in silicon, and one of the big innovations there is, the way we do a lot of machine learning, via TensorFlow and PyTorch and the like, is by, constructing computational graphs. So let's build silicon that, is better suited towards computational graphs as opposed to linear instruction sets. Now we're talking about graph databases. I don't think I've heard of like a graph server or a graph hardware that's kind of tuned for supporting graph databases. Have you heard of that? And do you think that may be a thing at some point?
I mean, honestly, from my standpoint, hardware has steadily gotten worse. Instruction pipelines are longer.
Okay.
People tend to focus on Well, if you can do serial I/O, then it's much, much faster. They want things to fit in the L1 cache. So the sweet spot for modern hardware is I have figured out how to chop things up into small enough pieces that one piece fits in the L1 cache, and then I can use vectorized operations really fast. That's absolutely wonderful. Unfortunately, that's not what a graph is. Mm-hmm. A graph is really random access, right? There's no easy way to sort a graph. So for example, if I'm storing edges, well, the edge has, say, three fields, a subject, predicate, and object. I have to sort in one way. So if I sort by subject, I can find all of your edges very easily. But when I start looking at objects at the other end, it's unsorted, right? So you really cannot escape the need for random access. And unfortunately, modern processors are very heavily pipelined and don't handle random access very well.
So do you envision a hardware that's better? Have you come across that?
I think people are doing the best they can. It's very hard and expensive. So, we have L1 memory. Why don't we just make L1 be like all of the RAM? It's very expensive to do that.
Heyman, when you think about the, a lot of the challenges that we've been talking about are challenges that arise from kind of the scale at which LinkedIn is manipulating graphs and applying machine learning to graphs. Not a lot of people are operating at that scale.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about kind of scaling down this kind of problem and getting started thinking about applying machine learning to graph types of problems, what are some of the things that people can do to explore this area?
There are definitely lots of graph data sets out in the public domain. The Clue Web corpus is a web graph in itself. Clue Web.
Okay.
There are academic publications that reference protein interaction networks. You can think of those as graphs as well. So there's lots of embodiments of graphs in different subdomains. The set of problems that come to mind often is it often boils down to link prediction. Does a link between A and B exist? Another problem that actually many companies, in particular financial institutions, are generally interested in is interaction graphs, but thinking in terms of the problem of abuse. So the general problem of link prediction has many applications, both in the public domain, as well as, the niche, corporate domains. So I think thinking about newer classes of link prediction problems that go beyond random walks, bringing embedding-like algorithms, basically deep learning algorithms, but that can operate at scale. So basically, how can we distribute the processing? Thinking about distributed graphs is itself a hard problem. The other piece that we didn't cover too much about, but I think for folks who are academically oriented, I would actually think about how do you do A/B testing on a graph? Because in some sense, nodes are not IID. When you expose a node to a particular treatment, its neighborhood is impacted too. So a very nice theoretical problem may be just, taking a look at how we might actually do experiments mm-hmm. on these graph structures.
So IID, independent, identically distributed.
Yes.
So what's the missing part of the academic literature in this area?
So think about this. Today, when most companies do A/B testing, or they partition their user base into mm-hmm. random buckets, right? But when your users are connected by links, right? So for example, let's take the example that you and I are connected and you share an article, and I view the article. But if we're in two different buckets for an A/B test, I'm not really independent of you.
Right.
So that assumption completely breaks apart. So how do we actually tackle this problem? I think that's something you can study even in a smaller graph in a more in a simulation-like framework. So I would, you know, sort of love to toss that problem out at the academics.
Scott, any requests from your part for the academic community?
I don't really have requests. You were talking about, you know, how do you process this at small scale? And I think one of the insights here is it's actually pretty economic to have a lot of RAM, right? And so if I was wanting to do graph work at a smaller scale, where small probably means, you know, up to 3 terabytes, I would just focus on a single machine and use RAM. I think you can buy a 1.5 terabyte machine from Dell at the rack price for $20,000, $25,000. It's really quite economical.
And if you didn't have access to Liquid, what graph database would you be exploring?
That's a harder one. I know the guys at Franz who build Allegro Graph, and I think that's to me, probably the most interesting of the extant graph databases.
Well, Hema, Scott, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you so much for having us here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Hema, Scott, or any of the topics covered in today's show, visit twimmelai.com/talk/236. Thanks once again to LinkedIn for their support. Be sure to check out what their engineering team is up to at engineering.linkedin.com/blog. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.